Tate Ministries, you can roll them. Again, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Chuck Kuhnert. I teach at Concordia College in Portland, Oregon, in the area of biology. Today's topic is the effect of man on ecosystems, and basically what I'd like to present to you is a state of the world ecosystem as of this date, and try and sort through some of the incredibly complex information that is available to us, and see if we can come to some bottom line understandings of what that means for us today and for humans in the future, as well as at what it might mean for other organisms that live on the face of the earth. To begin with, I think when we talk about ecosystems, we must understand that ecosystems are systems of two components. They are systems of biological and non-biological, or what we call abiotic components. So ecosystems are the interaction between living organisms and their non-living environment, and the impact that each has on the other. In a normal, natural setting, ecosystems are confined in space. That is, we can talk about the ecosystem of the tropical rainforest that is confined to perhaps one drainage basin of the Amazon River. We can talk about the inland desert of Arizona and New Mexico in the northern hemisphere. Those are confined areas. We can the ecosystem concept is a little bit flexible in that it allows the seeker of information to define the ecosystem according to their needs. We could talk about the ecosystem of Railroad Creek drainage basin, in other words, this valley from Lake Chelan to the top of the mountains beyond Lyman Lake, and that would be a legitimate definition of an ecosystem. And then when we did that, we would look at the types of forest trees that are present, the types of animals that are present, the human activities that are involved, as well as the input of solar radiation from the sun, the transfer of that energy between those organisms in this ecosystem, the resulting waste products that those organisms form, and how they affect the other organisms in the ecosystem. However, when we begin to talk about man, we encounter a unique problem. And I would like to venture to say that this is the complicating problem of the 20th century, and that is the ease of transportation of human beings. So we no longer have the capacity to define human ecosystems in narrow terms, because in fact we have become a global community. We have ease of access, basically, from any part of the world to any other part of the world now. Whereas only 200 years ago, or even only 100 years ago, that was very difficult. In fact, ease of access really is a phenomenon of about the period 1960 to the present, when commercial airline transportation really came into the forefront. What that means for us as ecologists looking at the world is that we now have to take into account how people in every part of the world affect organisms and are affected by non-living factors and living factors from all over the world. Have various connotations that have been used. Barry Commoner talked about the spaceship Earth, to call attention to the fact that we're now in basically an enclosed environment. Very little matter is coming into the earth from the outside. Very little matter is leaving the earth from its surface. Everything's pretty much what you see is what you get in terms of matter. And in that sense, it's much like a spaceship. And everything inside that spaceship really is dependent on everything else and interacting with everything else. Well, that adds to the complexity of the scene because the Earth, in one sense, is a very large structure. So, men, despite their other wishes, are very small people compared to the Earth. The Earth is a very large entity, and our impact on the Earth has been much magnified over what one would expect biologically from the size of our organism and even from the number of individuals of our species present on the face of the Earth. With that in mind, let me suggest that you cannot look at human ecosystem concept without first understanding what I consider to be the root of the problem. And that is graphically displayed on these two charts that we have up in front of you today. And I'd like to just walk through them. This is probably nothing surprising to most of you, but some of the features of it may surprise you, perhaps by their scope. It's instructive just to look at raw population data for the Earth over the past 10,000 or 12,000 years. If we look at 10,000 BC, it's estimated that probably 5 to 10 million humans were on the face of the Earth at that time. At that time, humans were basically gatherers, and that's how they obtained their food, that's how they obtained their shelter, their clothing. Agriculture wasn't invented yet, and people needed large expanses of territory in order to support themselves. If the humans on the face of the Earth continued to be gatherers for their food supply, rather than producing intensive agricultural techniques, the Earth would have the potential, maybe, of supporting 20 million people. Okay, so you have to frame the idea of population always with reference to our ability to produce food. By the time Christ was on the Earth, the population had grown to 138 million. That's a 10,000 year span of time to increase by 128 million people. By 1000, the population had doubled to 275 million people. By 650 years later, it had doubled again. So it took 1,000 years to double the first time. It took 650 years to double the second time. 200 years later, it had doubled again. By 1850, we had 1.1 billion people on the face of the Earth. 85 years later, it had doubled again. By 1935, it was 2.2 billion. 45 years later, by 1980, it had doubled again to 4.4 billion people. 10 years later, it had increased by 1.1 billion people to 5.3 billion, which it currently is. It is estimated by the people who do these sorts of things that the population of the world in the year 2025 will be 8.5 billion. Which is nearly double this figure. So it would be another 45-year doubling cycle. 45 years here, 45 years here. Now, obviously, if you put another layer on that to 45 years, that would be 2070 AD, and the population would be 17 billion. To give you the feel for that, in this century, from 1850 to 1950, we went from 1.1 to about, in 1950, about 3.2 billion. And from 1950 to 2050, we would go from 3.2 billion to about 15 billion if everything stays the same. Yeah.
I know this looks ominous, but wasn't Malthus' predictions even more graver?
In terms of population size?
Right. The exponential growth of the population is actually the trend is slowing down.
Yeah. Let me get to that right here. Let me say a couple things before I get to that. And another way to look at this is that in the period between 1950 and today, we have produced as many people on the face of the earth as the entire history of mankind before that period. So in those 40 years, we've made as many human beings on the face of the earth as populated the earth prior to that time. That's a lot of human beings. Now, if we look at this, and I'll get back to the rape question in just a second, because that's a critical question. But I think there's something else to be said about this population increase, because population increase is not going to be uniform across the face of the earth. And that has grave implications for our impact on the ecosystem, and we need to understand that. The best predictions we have right now are that the population increase that we see here between now and the year 2070, which is not even, that's what I was doing up here, was just saying if we added another 45 years and doubled again, it would get to 17 billion. The predictions are that it won't go that high. The predictions are that by 2070, we'll have about 10.3 billion people on the face of the earth because of what you're suggesting, which is a gradual rate decline in population increase. So the likely population, rather than 17 billion, is 10.3 billion. Now, of that of the increase between 1990 today and 2025, which amounts to 3.2 billion people, of that, only 5% or 200 million will be in the developed countries of the world. 95% of that increase of 3.2 billion people is projected to take place in the underdeveloped or third world countries in the world. 95%. So that if we look at this graph today, we are at this point in the graph, or somewhere around there. And if you look at where we will be perhaps 100 years from now, you can see right away some of the problems that the world is going to face. Now, obviously, we already have an attempt by the countries that are classified many times as third world countries to become developed. And they are, in fact, in many cases, doing that. So the nature of underdeveloped and developed will be in a state of flux as well. But the location of the population increase will be in those countries that we currently consider underdeveloped. It will taper off. There's no doubt about that. Malthus told us that already in the 1700s. The question is, how will it taper off? Now, looking at the rate of increase between 1980 and 1985, that five-year span of time, the rate of increase on the Earth, population increase on the Earth, was 9%. Okay. Between 2020 and 2025, this is another five-year period, it is anticipated that the rate of increase will be 4%. Okay. Well, now that's the good news. Now the bad news is that 9% of the population in 1980 is the same as 4% of the population in 2020, roughly 400 million. So despite the fact that the rate will decline, the absolute numbers of people on the face of the earth will continue to climb because the total population will be so great. Okay? So even though the rate is declining, the population is going to grow for the foreseeable future. Unless, of course, things change. Now, what I'd like to do at this point is begin to take a look at the impact that this population growth has had on different areas of our world. And some of them are obvious to you and some may not be obvious. I don't want to beat dead horses. We've already had one session on global warming and talked about atmospheric conditions caused by CO2 levels. And we mentioned a little bit of ozone depletion in that. But I think it's instructive to methodically go through the state of the world, if you would, the ecosystem state of the world, and sort of get a snapshot of where we are right now and look back over the past decade to see where we've come in that decade, whether positive or negative, and look ahead toward what we might be faced with in the future. Now, one of the first areas of concern when you talk about population increase is health. Obviously, as the numbers of individuals on the face of the earth increase, the likelihood of decreasing ability to support life goes up as well. Specifically, in some areas of the world, we're very concerned about health in the areas of nutrition, of levels of intake of calories which are insufficient to sustain life. Africa's population growth, while the rest of the world is anticipated to be declining, Africa's population growth is increasing, and its rate of increase is accelerating rather than decelerating. By the year 2025, Africa's population is anticipated to surpass that of North America, South America, and Europe combined.
Does Africa have the carrying capacity for that?
It does not. Yet, under the current agricultural conditions, it does not. And we'll get to that in a moment as well. Java, as an example, grew from 5 million to 95 million in this century. Because of the nature of Java, which is a very mountainous region, the people were forced to occupy hillsides and steep mountain slopes to attempt to raise food crops for their existence. That resulted and has continues to result in terrific erosion, degradation of the ecosystem, because of course in order to do that they have to clear the forest from those lands, and the erosion coupled with the loss of root support systems in these soils makes much of the soil that they have occupied now totally incapable of even subsistence level agricultural techniques. In fact, in Java, over 1 million hectares have been so degraded that they can no longer be used for raising food crops at all. Five hundred thousand women worldwide die in childbirth every year. 99% of them are from third world countries. 15 million children under the age of 5 die worldwide every year. 5 million of them die from diarrheal diseases, which are caused by largely by poor sanitation facilities and living in conditions, slum conditions, a poor ability to store food, and inability to obtain necessary medical treatment. A unique new problem on the face of the earth with respect to health, of course, is the AIDS pandemic. And some of you may be aware of the scope of this problem. Most, I think, are largely unaware of it. Today, worldwide, about 85,000 cases of AIDS, this is worldwide, 85,000 cases of full-blown AIDS have been reported. Of that 85,000, 43,000, roughly half, are dead. And the prognosis for the other 42,000 is that they will die from 6 to 9 years after the first indication that they have gone on to AIDS. Now, let me repeat that number, 85,000 worldwide. By the way, about 70,000 of those are in the United States have been reported with full-blown AIDS. In the United States alone, 1.5 million people are thought to be infected with the AIDS virus. They will all die within the next 10 years unless a cure for AIDS is found. Worldwide, between 5 and 10 million people are infected with the AIDS virus. All of them will die. In some countries in Western Africa, 50% of the population is infected with AIDS. 50%. And the even more remarkable part of that is that by and large, the vast majority of those infected are also the primary workers in those economies. They are people from the ages of 18 to 40, 45. They are the people who are most likely to have AIDS by far. And those economies in some of those countries are going to be absolutely devastated within the next decade because of that health problem, which is a reflection to a certain extent of the population problem.
Are those numbers, the 1.5 million, are those undiagnosed?
Those are undiagnosed based on screenings that have been done from random screenings that are done nationwide and worldwide.
And is the reason we have so much percentage of that 85,000 is because we have better diagnosis? You know, people go in for care?
No, it's not. It is because the AIDS pandemic largely started in the United States. And it exploded here first. The AIDS virus that's infecting Africa started a little bit, approximately the same time, perhaps a little bit later, but it's etiology is a little bit different, and it is primarily heterosexually transmitted in Africa, and epidemic nature, the course of the epidemic was different than it was in America, and so it's been slower in building, but it now has infected many more people than that in America.
But the numbers aren't there with the African. I was surprised to see that American numbers are so greater part of the percentage. I thought the African would start to, because it's 4%.
It will soon. But it's the like Botswana, for example. I think is one of the most heavily infected. And in Botswana, as of May 89, which is the last data I had, they had something like 796 reported cases. As opposed to America, where we had, in May of 89, we had about 68,000 or something like that reported cases.
Does that country half of the population is projected to have?
Yes. Well, they can do that from serology tests now. When I say 797 people have AIDS, I mean they have the symptoms of AIDS. Okay. AIDS is a disease that progresses through stages. And what we're talking about here is the last stage, full-blown AIDS.
Would you believe the figure I was told this spring by a father whose son is a doctor in New York City, that 10% of the beds are taken by AIDS patients?
I would not only believe, but I would predict that by the end of this century in America, 25% of all hospital beds will be occupied by AIDS patients, or they will not have the ability to get into hospitals. Right now, San Francisco is often held up as a model of response to the AIDS problem because of a clinic that they have for treatment of AIDS victims, and that indeed is a fine clinic. However, I think the figure is only 1 in 4 AIDS victims in San Francisco has access to that clinic. The other 3/4 of the AIDS victims are largely kept at home and monitored by friends or home nurses or whatever. And the economic impact on the world is going to be enormous.
Is that going to cause a blip in the...
Not significant. Not significant. When you're talking about 10 million people in a world population of 8 billion, it's not a significant number. I mean, it's obvious, don't get me wrong, it's obviously a significant number of people dying, but when you're comparing it to this, it might give a little jog in it, but that's not a very big percentage of the world population. And that, of course, those 5 to 10 million infected are going to be dying out over a period of about 5 to 6 years rather than all at once.
That's assuming no growth in the AIDS epidemic.
Right, that's assuming no growth. Well, no, it's not assuming no growth. That's assuming the growth as it currently is projected to occur. Okay, that's how many are infected now, 5 to 10 million. And we don't know what the scope of that will be. I had a report, I think, from the Bangkok, Thailand, 1986. They did a study of prostitutes in Bangkok to test their serum for HIV, the AIDS virus. In 1986, something like 6% of the population of prostitutes tested positive for HIV. In 1987, 22% tested positive for HIV. And in 1988, 67% of the prostitutes tested positive for HIV. So in localized areas, now I don't want to give you the impression that it's typical worldwide, but in localized areas of specific at-risk populations, the explosion continues. Right now, the nature of that viral infection is changing in America drastically. Up until this point, it was by and large, up until about 3 years ago, it was by and large homosexual males, and to a much lesser extent, IV drug users and people who had received transfusions of unscreened blood. Now, it's number of cases of homosexual males contracting AIDS is plummeting, largely due to education, because quite frankly, the homosexual male population is by and large extremely literate and is has very good access to educational programs. And so their precautions during sexual activities and so on has reduced their incidence of AIDS dramatically. At the same time, the incidence of AIDS among IV drug users, particularly, and prostitutes, has risen tremendously and has more than made up for the loss of or lack of homosexual male AIDS victims. It still has not this percentage of heterosexual, non-drug using individuals contracting AIDS has not changed since records were first kept. It has not changed significantly. It's about 4% and remains at that. So the people who had predicted a tremendous increase in the heterosexual population, it looks like they were unjustified in that right now. It's still largely an at-risk type of disease. Well, in Africa, it is also, the difference is in Africa, and this is I want to be careful how I state this. The difference is in Africa, the social mores are different. And it is largely in Africa being spread initially, at any rate, by prostitution. There is a much higher incidence of prostitution in many of those countries than there is in America, because it is in many of those countries socially acceptable, morally acceptable for those individuals to come off the farm. Basically what happens is they come off the farm on the weekends when they get their paycheck and they go into the big cities of those places. You know, utilize the services of a prostitute and then go home to their wives and then infect their wives back at home. So that's been the big problem in Africa. Any other questions? Okay, I don't want to get off too much on AIDS. That's kind of interesting, though. One little piece of information that's also helpful with respect to population and health is the concept that in the United States, worldwide rather, pesticides, the use of pesticides kills between 3 and 20,000 people annually outright, and perhaps another million people have their health compromised by pesticides and residues from pesticides. The flip side of that record, and there is one, and I think it's, in fairness we need to understand that, the flip side of that record is that, in fact, all living organisms produce natural pesticides. All living plants produce natural pesticides. That is, apples have material in them which, when they're attacked by an apple maggot moth, they produce to counteract the apple maggot moth, just in the same way that our body has an immune system that fights off bacterial infections. Those agents produced naturally are in fact as toxic or more toxic and produced in larger quantities than we're applying in terms of pesticide control. Now, that case will be argued probably for another 10 years before a conclusion to that argument comes and enough scientific data is established. But that argument is being raised in Science Magazine over the past year by some pretty high-powered, well-known scientists, that just cutting off pesticides will not necessarily decrease the risk of cancer in people, because in documented cases, plants naturally sometimes produce more cancer-causing agents than we're spraying on them. The other aspect of pesticide utilization is the amount of increase in agricultural production that has resulted because of it. And it has been very dramatic. In the past 20 years, which is the second topic I want to get into, which is food and agriculture, in the past 20 years worldwide, food production per capita, that is per individual, has increased 25%. We are today worldwide producing 25% more food per person than we were 20 years ago. In some areas, like in China and Indonesia and Malaysia, that figure is 45% in the last 20 years. This is part of what's been called the Green Revolution, where intensive agricultural techniques have been imported into third world developing countries to help them get over their food shortages. Unfortunately, of course, that increase in food production worldwide hasn't been felt by everybody. And most notably, some areas of the world have actually decreased in per capita food production. The most notable is sub-Saharan Africa, which has decreased by 13% in that same 20-year period due to a combination of two major things. One was not man-caused. It was an unusual period environmentally in terms of climate. They had the worst series of droughts and the warmest temperatures that they had recorded in the past 100 years during that two-decade period. And the second is man-caused, and that's a problem called desertification, converting grazing lands into deserts by man's activity, actually by animals' activity at the direction of man. Desertification occurs two ways. It occurs naturally when the atmosphere over a specific area gets drier for some reason or another. And we talked about that 2 days ago when we talked about global warming. They predict that's going to happen in much of the central part of the northern hemisphere and the central part of the U.S. Kansas and Nebraska will become more like New Mexico and Arizona if that global warming trend continues. But the bigger problem and the more immediate problem is that when you overgraze, when you let your cattle eat the grass plants, the grazing plants, down so that they kill off the part of the plant that regenerates growth, the plant dies off. The soil then does not hold moisture anymore because the roots of the plant aren't there to firm up the soil and provide texture to the soil. And so the soil itself becomes desert-like. This has happened in America in the past century. If you read the accounts of the people who traveled in their wagon trains over the Oregon Trail, when they get to the Central Oregon Plateau, the Central Oregon Plateau is covered by bunch grass, which is 5 to 6 feet tall, all over the place. And if you see pictures, and there are some tintypes and things like that of cowboys in the Central Oregon Plateau in the 1870s, they are riding horses in areas where the grass is as high as the back of the horse. And anybody who's been to Central Oregon knows that that ain't what it looks like today. It is, in fact, a virtual desert. We have sagebrush, we have bitterbrush, we have junipers, things that have tremendously long taproots that can get down to water aquifers that are 40 feet or more below the surface of the ground. But the bunch grasses are largely gone. There are still some preserves in various locations where they have actual grassland refuges where they are trying to preserve those, and they're trying to reestablish bunch grass in various spots. But the problem is the soil moisture content has already been reduced so much that that's not possible in many places. So desertification in the sub-Saharan, the Sahara is not all like you picture it with camels going over big sand dunes. The Sahara, 100 years ago, had quite a bit of capacity to raise crops. And it is man's activities over the past 100 years that has at least impacted its ability to do so.
How much has it increased, the
desert? The figures were in the reference book that I'm getting this material from, and it's in that the library over here. It's a significant amount. Yeah, probably. And my guess is offhand in the neighborhood of maybe 15 to 20% in the past quarter century. Okay. Now, despite the overall 25% increase, there's also an additional problem in world hunger in that distribution of those foods is not random. It is biased. So, right now, 1 billion people are considered at a substandard level of nourishment, going to bed hungry each day, if you will. 1 out of every 5 people in the world. And nations with a per capita income of under $400 per year make up 80% of those people. So that means 800 million people live in nations with per capita income of under $400 per year and are malnourished. The other feature of the food production increase that must be taken into account is that it does not come cheap. In order to do that, we need what ecologists call energy subsidies. the ecosystems that those farms are located in must be subsidized with energy from the outside in two basic forms. One, in the form of fertilizers that are made in industrial plants in other parts of the world and then carted there and placed on the land to increase production. And two, in utilization of oil to intensify agriculture, you have to use big combines instead of having individual people out picking wheat with a scythe. You have to have large tractors that use diesel fuel to plow the land rather than having an ox that plows it in front of a handheld plow. So all those factors do increase food production, but they also complicate the situation with respect to the ecosystem. The fertilizers, of course, primary source of water pollution and air pollution, and the utilization of the diesel and other oils causes the carbon dioxide increase in the environment. So it's a complex thing. You pay the piper anytime you mess with the ecosystem. Next, I'd like to look at forests and rangelands. We talked a little bit about rangelands already, so we've covered that, but we haven't talked about forests yet. I was at a conference in Davis, California 2 years ago of the American Institute of Biological Sciences, which is largely ecologists, and a gentleman there was giving a slide presentation on the tropical rainforests of Brazil, and it was one of the most emphatic demonstrations that you could imagine, and it took three slides to do it. What he did was he showed a satellite photo of a region of the Amazon jungle in 1986, 1987, and 1988, the identical same region. In 1985, a road had been blown through the tropical rainforest right down the center of this photo. Prior to 1985, there was no urban development at all. There was no development in that area. That was entirely tropical rainforest. And this is a huge area I'm talking about, not a small area. I think we're talking here about the slides covered somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 miles in one direction, just one slide. In the 1986 slide, you could see a few patches where the forest had been cleared. It was done with infrared photography, so you can tell the difference between the living and the bare soil by the colors. By 1987, about half of the forest within 30 miles of that road had been cleared. By 1988, about three quarters of it had been cleared. So in 3 years' time, this 300-mile-long segment of the tropical rainforest that was about 60 miles wide had virtually been denuded of trees in 3 years. Each year, 11 million hectares of tropical rainforest are lost. 11 million hectares. The figure right now is something like 1 acre per second of tropical rainforest is being leveled.
What's replacing it? What's it?
Primarily grazing land, but it's a twofold problem. One of the problems is that worldwide 50% of the energy, 50% of the people in the world use wood for their only source of energy. Okay. Those people have run out of places to cut. And in the tropical rainforests of the world, a lot of the wood cutting that's going on is to supply them with fuel wood. The other part, probably 30%, 70% type of situation. The other problem is that a lot of the rainforests are being cleared to convert them into grazing land or other agricultural purposes, raising crops for food or cattle for food. And let me back up and say that there's a real problem with that. Tropical rainforests at first blush, if you would look at a tropical rainforest and then look at a desert, you might say to yourself, well, you know, the soil in tropical rainforest is much richer than the soil in the desert. In fact, just the opposite is true. Desert soil is much more productive than is tropical rainforest soil. The reason is tropical rainforests are tropical rainforests. They're called tropical rainforests because they get about 250 inches of rain a year or more, some of them up to 400 inches of rain a year. 400 inches of rain a year dropping on the soil leaches out the nutrients very rapidly. Desert soils, on the other hand, that have not been impacted by heavy rains, have largely retained whatever nutrients they've received in their native material. They haven't been leached out. It's complicating that. When you denude a tropical rainforest, if you chop the rainforest off, pull up all the stumps, and have this bare soil there, when the rain falls on it, it's falling directly on its soil. It takes the humus, the top layer that has accumulated for a little while, and it washes it off along with your topsoil. So in those places where agricultural reasons are given for chopping down the tropical rainforests, we have a very short-sighted policy because those tropical rainforests are fertile for only usually 2 to 3 crops. And then in the fourth year, they have to abandon the area because it can no longer raise crops.
But that still hasn't slowed down destruction of the...
Well, no, that hasn't. However, in fairness to Brazil and Thailand and some of the other countries, the governments themselves have, in certain cases, taken drastic steps. In fact, I think in Thailand, all logging has been stopped now. They don't allow any logging.
Teak or mahogany or something?
Mahogany and teak largely come from the Southeast Asian areas. In Brazil, world pressure has been so great recently, last 3-4 years, that the Brazilian government is taking steps to reduce the amount of deforestation that's occurring. It's still occurring at an extremely rapid rate, however. So time will tell. In addition to the loss of tropical rainforest due to deforestation, 15% of the forests of Northern Europe have been damaged significantly by air pollution, by acid rain. Some to the point where they probably will not be able to recover until they do some regeneration of the soil, neutralizing the acid that's fallen in the soil. On the other hand, the positive, if you want to look at it that way, the positive statement is that 57% of the world's closed forests are temperate forests, the type of forests we have in the Northwest. And though the amount of temperate forests is actually increasing worldwide and has for the past decade. The reason being more and more land is being dedicated to tree farming, if you will. And so although the forest type may be a little artificial, we are getting more trees than we had 10 years ago.
Isn't most of the CO2 conversion though done on the ocean surface?
Oh, by far, yes.
So really the ocean degradation is by far the greatest impact.
Yeah, although degradation of the ocean's plankton, phytoplankton, the plankton that does the photosynthesis, is probably very limited at this point. It really hasn't been affected too much by pollution yet. In fact, if anything, it may have been increased because of the amount of phosphates and nitrates that we've been dumping into the ocean. So
the deforestation problem, in the sense of air quality questions, is not really as significant.
Well, it's still a very significant feature, okay?
Percentage-wise and everything.
Yeah, it really is a significant feature because the forests are not only being deforested, they're being burned. So you're dumping, you're producing tremendous quantities of carbon dioxide from those trees that are being burned. that, the amount is something like, well, the amount of carbon dioxide produced artificially in the world is divided into two major components. One is deforestation and burning of the forest products, and the other is industrial and automobile uses of fossil fuels. The deforestation accounts for somewhere between 20% and 30% of it. And that amount, the amount, that is the critical amount. See, the amount produced by the plankton in the ocean is part of the natural balance, because that's just a cycle and that's always balanced. And the amount produced by the trees on the forest lands and the grasses and the grazing lands, that's all just a recycling process. It's all in balance. But when we do the fossil fuels and when we do the cut down the tropical rainforest and burn them, that's extra load that's being dumped up there. And it is a significant proportion of the total. We've increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the past 30 years by about 30%.
But the conversion capability hasn't decreased that much, right?
Oh, no, it has not. In other words, but in other words, the balance, if we eliminated all fossil fuel burning and we didn't cut down any tropical rainforests and burn them, then we would be in balance. I don't know if I'm...
But it's from the pollution point of view rather than the carrying conversion capabilities the biggest concern. Right?
For cutting down the tropical rainforest?
Right.
Yeah,
so
right, that's
pollution
right.
And energy,
sure.
Oxygen.
Right, certainly. Right. Well, in fact, in those places where the tropical rainforest is being cut down, actually the plants that are being produced, like if they do intensive agriculture with corn, you're probably making more oxygen in that acre of land than you would have in the tropical rainforest being present. The tropical rainforest as a mature forest is not terribly productive. Tropical rainforests have a very slow life cycle, and their metabolism rate as such is very slow as well. So that old trees and of any type do not produce a tremendous amount of oxygen compared to young, vibrantly growing plants and trees. A younger forest is really much more productive in terms of oxygen than is an older forest.
Another thing about the rainforest destruction that I've heard is this phrase biodiversity.
Right. I'm going to get into that when I talk about wildlife and habitat. Now we can get into it now. It's sort of the... Well, no, let me hold off, because I want to talk about one other thing. When we talk about forests and tree areas, one of the impacts that humans have made is sort of a comical one. It really is. Anybody here live in Arizona? Yes, God did. Okay. Here's what happened. In the 1930s in America, people in the northern states, 1930s and 40s, people in the northern states were complaining to their doctors about hay fever, sneezing, watery eyes. They were tired of the cold. They were tired of the snow. The doctor said, snow in the wintertime, hay fever in spring and summer, shoot, move to Arizona. So all these people said, let's move to Arizona. So they all moved to Arizona. So they got down to Arizona, which is largely desert where they were moving, and they had all these strange shrubs. They had cacti. They had plants with thick watery leaves. They didn't recognize those things. They didn't have a lot of shade trees. So they got in these, largely in the 40s and 50s, they got into mobile homes and things like that that had air conditioning, and they sat in these things and they said, boy, this is great, I can breathe again, but this is boring. I don't want to sit in here inside closed up in this air-conditioned mobile home. I want to sit on under the shade tree like I did back home in Ohio and Michigan and Minnesota and wherever. So why don't we bring trees from Ohio and Michigan down to Arizona and we'll plant them there, and then I can sit out under the shade of my old elm tree and just enjoy myself. We'll have the best of both worlds. So they did. So they took all these trees that were native to the Midwest and the upper Midwest, and they brought them down to Arizona. Well, number one, they require gobs of water to maintain. So they had to be out there spending half the morning watering these trees to get them to grow. Number two, they produced the pollen that they sought to flee by moving from Ohio and Michigan down to Arizona, and the pollen index in Phoenix is worse than it is back home in Ohio now. So the doctors are telling them to move from Phoenix back to Ohio to get rid of the pollen problems. And you know, and then they wanted a green lawn like they had back home, so they put in lawns and they had to water them like crazy, and so it's really, I mean, the impact of humans on the environment is sometimes comical. If we just stop to think what we're doing and why we're doing it, it sometimes makes no sense whatsoever. Let's get to the wildlife and habitat destruction, because I think that ties in with what we were talking about before. Tropical rainforests occupy 6% of the Earth's surface, and they have 70% of all the species on the Earth of plants and animals. They contain 70% of all the species known on the face of the Earth. So when you cut an acre of tropical rainforest, you may in fact be eliminating an entire species. The ecological principle is niche diversity increases as you go toward the equator. And a niche is an occupation, a job for an individual organism. If you go to the poles, if you go up near the Arctic, you have fewer niches, therefore you have fewer types of organisms, and you have them in huge numbers. Anybody that's been up in Alaska fishing in the summertime knows that if you stand out on the riverbank, you get eaten alive by mosquitoes. There aren't many species of insects up there, but the ones they have in large numbers. Okay, in tropical rainforest, you don't. You may have only 100 representatives of a particular type of butterfly in the whole tropical rainforest, but you may have several thousand species of differently colored butterflies in that forest. Whereas up here in the Holden Valley, we probably have 7 or 8 species of colorful butterflies. So the biodiversity that the scientists are really concerned about now is a complex idea. Basically, the bottom line is, if we chop down our tropical rainforests, we are going to reduce the number of species of individuals on the face of the Earth considerably. And if we do that, we have a tendency then, there's a problem then, in reducing genetic diversity worldwide in all organisms. And genetic diversity is necessary for the health of organisms. All of you know that you can't marry your first cousin. Okay, why? Because if you marry your first cousin, you do what's called inbreeding. You have their bad genetic traits and your bad genetic traits, which are masked in you and them, some of them are. And you put them together, and they appear in your children. And so you get a high preponderance of mentally retarded children or physically deformed children or whatever. That's why there are laws against marrying your first cousin. Not because people want to restrict your access or freedom, but because they're concerned about the next generation. In nature, likewise, if we reduce the number of species, that increases the chance that we're going to be inbreeding those individuals we have left. And the health of the entire population of the world then suffers long term. Yeah.
Well, isn't it also that they're finding some incredible medicines now? Some of this exotic...
They are, although the argument against that, quite frankly, is that we now have the capacity to make a gene bank, if you will, of the genetic material of every organism on the face of the Earth if we'd like. And we can clone that. We can stick it into bacteria or other organisms and produce whatever product we want to produce artificially. We don't need the organisms to do that. But species have to raise new species. We don't have the technology yet to make species just from their genes.
Plus the inventory process is still not very far along, is it?
Oh, no, it's not very far along at all. There's about you know, we only know of 1.7 million species of plants and animals on the face of the earth. That's how many we've cataloged. And some people estimate there may be 20 million species on the face of the earth.
Especially the rainforest.
Right, exactly. Especially, and again, some people, I said 70%, some people estimate 90% of all species are in the tropical rainforest. So anyway, it's a problem. Well, what time did we start here?
10:03.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to have to get finished with this. Let me wrap this up then. I have a lot to go, but we won't do that. Obviously, humans have had a great impact and continue to have a great impact on the environment. We have made some strides, and I want to talk about a couple positive things before we wrap up. A couple of them are in the area of air pollution and water pollution. In the last decade, actually water pollution and air pollution in developed countries has decreased. The quality of air and water has increased by most of the standards. There are a couple of chemicals that have not significantly improved in air pollution, but most have. Classic example is the Willamette River in Portland that runs right through Portland, Oregon. 20 years ago, it was an unusable river for any purpose. It was so foul. Now it's basically a crystal clear river with people swimming it and fishing in it, using it for recreational purposes constantly. And that's happened quite a bit across America. Lake Michigan, we went home to my wife's home in St. Joseph, Michigan 2 years ago and swam in the lake. And I went out to a place where I could see 20 feet deep and I could see the bottom in 20 feet of water in Lake Michigan. And 15 years ago, that was unthinkable. It was a sewage dump. So there has been a lot of progress in cleaning up the waterways of America. Of course, a lot more has to be done, notably Railroad Creek to start with. But there is progress being made on those fronts. So all is not bleak, and there is hope for the future. And we need, as Christians, I think, to respond to our status as sort of caretakers of this ecosystem by being responsible users of the materials that we have before us. Any comments or last questions? Sort of a global thing. Anybody? Yeah.
One of the concerns I remember 20 years ago about the ocean, plankton in the ocean, one was they were washing out their oil ships and using the ocean water. And of course, there's a lot of oil going into the ocean today, which of course could affect plankton.
Yeah.
And then the whales feed on it.
Right.
And by destroying the whales, maybe, I don't know, feeding on it maybe helps the plankton.
Well,
two
things. One is, with the exception of a couple of notable bad scenes like the Exxon Valdez, actually the oceans are cleaner now than they were 20 years ago because of strict regulations on bilge dumping and things like that that have taken effect in the last 20 years. Obviously, we don't want to go dumping 11 million barrels of oil into the ocean.
Well, I thought it was Jacques Cousteau's, and there's hundreds and hundreds of miles of tracks of just dead ocean now, Central Pacific and so forth.
There certainly are areas that have been impacted by human activities, but I think the general consensus is because of the changes in regulations on shipping industries that at least has been impacted positively. It's certainly not taking care of all the problem. But there are ways we can, in fact, save the planet, if you will, from destruction by doing some reasonable things.